Today, inside the tent, how power really works. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Cameron Murray. Hi, Cameron.
G'day, Martin.
Great to have you on, and thanks for spending some time with us. Really important conversation today. You've just released a new book, which we'll get onto in a second. And it's interesting, somebody else on another show introduced you as an expert in corruption, which isn't quite perhaps the way I would put it, but you've been studying it in some detail. But you're also an economist, doing research at the University of Sydney. So, and very interested also in the housing dynamic too. So there's so much that we can talk about. But let's start with Rigged, which is a new release of a book that first came out in 2017 under a different title. And I guess the question is, why are you setting it out now and what's changed?
Yeah, thanks, Martin. So, yeah, the book is called Rigged. That's what it looks like now. And it originally came out as a self-published book in 2017 called Game of Mates, How Favours Bleed the Nation, which I thought was, a very good title. But, that was originally released as a way to communicate a lot of the research I'd been doing the previous 4 years during my PhD about political favoritism and grey corruption. And the purpose of that book was to get all those things I'd learnt out there into the public debate, because you can get certain things in academic journals and certain people read them, and you can say a few things to the press about those results in those papers, but there was a lot of additional analysis I did that just, it wasn't cut out for an academic paper, but as part of a book that put it all together, it made a lot of sense and provided a good sort of comprehensive lens for looking at political favoritism. So that was the purpose of that book. And we self-published it at the time thinking, well, it's 2017 and, we're both professional writers, and we'd approached a couple of publishers who wanted immediately to start imposing their views on things. So we thought, let's just do it. So it did quite well. And then Richard Walsh, who's runs Allen and Unwin, stumbled onto it last year and said, this is a great book. We'd like to publish it properly under our banner if you can refresh and update all the figures with new examples and make it relevant for the 2020s. And so we thought, well, the original book was more of a booklet. It had a lot of spelling mistakes and errors. We didn't have the professional process in place. So now this is a much more comprehensive, more complete, better written, more updated version of that, because all those topics are still relevant, right? Political favoritism hasn't just dried up since 2017, especially not in Australia.
And so the reason I think this is so relevant is because and some of the examples that you talk about are really across housing, mining, pretty much all the major power blocks across Australia. And there's a sort of almost a hidden set of rules that determine how things work, which are not actually the obvious ones, the ones that you might assume outside looking in. And in fact, you actually do separate those on the inside from those on the outside. Yeah. And I think that's quite an important contrast.
Yeah, so it's very hard to communicate abstractly this insiders, outsiders, networks of relationships type concept that we want to explain. So what we do in the book is we just take a representative insider. We call him James. James is the well-connected person who's able to exert influence over public decisions. We have our everyman outsider that in this book is called Sam, that represents the average Aussie household who's always on the outside of these decisions, always paying the cost when James gets a benefit. Now, that's a bit abstract because you can be the James in one area, in housing or mining, be a property developer and getting your favours, but still pay the premium to James when you buy pharmaceuticals or, your taxi or, your mortgage or whatever the case may be. So the true distribution is quite different, but I think it's much clearer to think of it on a sort of industry by industry basis as insiders and outsiders. And that's what we do. And, in the process, I think there's a lot of lessons about how political favoritism works that I think, contradict many of the sort of gut feelings we have out there. So we lay out sort of mechanically how the process, how you get favors. And in fact, some people have said, you've written a really good how-to guide for getting political influence because we explain this process quite clearly. And one of the lessons that you get from this, which I think is probably, you know, one of the more interesting and memorable ones, is political donations are often thought about as bribes, a purchase of a particular decision. But there's a few issues with that framework. The first is donations are much too small. You're giving away billions in political decisions often for tens of thousands in donations, which doesn't make sense, right? If I'm a politician, I should extort you for much, much more. Now, you might say there are constraints and it's still a purchase. And then the problem comes up, well, 60% of donations to politics in Australia come from donors who donate to both sides of politics equally. So the question is, well, if these are bribes because they're something good for you and your political party, doesn't donating to your opposition simply undermine their value to you by helping your competitor? So how can there be a net positive value for you from me donating to both sides of politics? So it doesn't seem like it's a payment. It's more of a signal of credit worthiness that you want to participate in a long run game of exchanging favors back and forth, not even just directly, but indirectly amongst a larger group. So that's one of those insights, and it resolves a lot of puzzles that we see in the data, and a lot of the puzzles about, you know, catching political favoritism. Another one is that people think, you know, if you have disclosure laws or codes of conduct and that sort of thing, that politicians know when they're doing the wrong thing, but that's also not true. A lot of them justify it to themselves and say, well, if the other guys would be worse, so this is the best possible way to do it, even though we're also ripping you off. And so if they get seen doing that, they can just say, I'm a smart politician, I'm doing what I think is best. So these codes of conduct that rely on you knowing what's good and bad also don't seem to do much work. So they're the types of insights you can get on the mechanics of political favoritism.
And the point I think that you want to underscore, this is a long-term game, isn't it? So it's almost not a transactional thing. It's a long-term building of influence and trajectory, which essentially means you end up with what you want over the medium to long-term rather than an individual transaction.
Oh, exactly. And I think, you know, there's some bright sides in the book. And one is that we're very good at capturing direct nepotism, cronyism, those transactional favors, which is why we call this more of a gray corruption political favoritism, is that this is not a transactional favor. This is a long-term exchange of favors that are probably mostly legal and okay to do, but when you add them up over time, are essentially stealing from the collective, the outsiders, the Sams, for the Jameses, the insiders. You're totally right. Yeah, it's a long-term game, and that's why. Yeah, so to sort of drive that point home, a lot of in the 2010s, the biggest political donors were Chinese property developers. And a lot of the smallest donors were the well-entrenched, you know, elites and well-connected property developers. So the question is, well, why are these new people doing the most favors, but not doing the most donation, but not getting the most favors? Well, they're signaling that in the future they want to get entrenched into this network, and so they have to sort of burn money, like joining the mafia, right? You gotta do a few small crimes together. You gotta show that you're not an outsider, that you want to be an insider, and that's sort of the beginning of a long-term process.
So I know that some of the international studies of corruption show that Australia's gone down the scale quite a long way in the last few years. So how do you think corruption here compares with other countries around the world?
That's a really interesting one. I think each country has its own flavor, style, technique, however you want to describe it, of actually getting political favors. And I think Australia has fallen down the rankings. It's called the Corruption Perceptions Index by Transparency International. It's fallen quite a lot in the last decade. And I think Australia, the interesting part is a lot of the favors we see aren't really so much illegal. It's not that, for example, John Barilaro gave himself a job. It's that, had he given someone else the job, that would have been just as bad, because that person would have then owed him the favor for creating that cozy $500,000 position with all the expenses and entourage that goes with it. So I think it's a bit more subtle in Australia. And the other thing is, I think Australians are a bit more naive about it. For example, look, I wrote, when I did a study on political networks and rezoning decisions in Queensland, and I wrote to the planning minister and said, here's the result of our study. Do you realize you took all these planning powers from the council and used them to essentially give $700 million worth of property rights to these well-connected landowners and developers? This was a huge sort of reallocation of wealth. And that office wrote back to me and said, we think it's the right thing to do to rezone property developers and let them have that those $700 million gains. We just think that's the right, that's how we should function. So when I say Australians are a bit naive to it, it's a bit like we take for granted that business as usual is often a little bit corrupt. And so we kind of let it slide until it gets really bad. And I actually think the rise of independent parties at the moment and the disinterest in the majors is a sort of signal. People are seeing that both sides are in it for themselves. No one's really representing the broader interests. And that's to me a real signal that we've sort of come down this cycle of corruption or favoritism, and that people are realizing it and organizing to change, which I think is very positive. And, you know, one of the very good long-term benefits of Australia is that, you know, things work generally pretty well, and when people get upset, they can organise and get some change.
Well, let's now move the conversation slightly forward, because, of course, over the last 2 days, there's been a big thing going on in Canberra, right? 140-odd people getting together talking about jobs and what have you, the summit. Now, let's look at it through the rigged lens,
yeah,
right? And think about what you said about influence and power play and those things. How do you interpret it in that context?
Yeah, so the way I see this is a great big coordination event. So it's all about insiders getting together to coordinate with each other, get their stories straight. So one of the ingredients to political favoritism is myth-making. You've got to have a story about why what's good for you and your mates is also good for the average Aussie. And so if you can all get together in a meeting like this, you can all get your story straight and say, well, this is good for us. This is how we're going to sell it. So I see it really as a coordination device. Everyone's signaling to each other that they're on the same page. This is what we want. And it's also about myth making. You know, Adam Smith knew that firms don't get together. What's the great quote? Firms won't get together and come away from it doing things in the interests of their customers. They'll always be colluding. And I think this is the political version of that. And all that talk of compromise is, I think, part of the cover story. So I can't really see great things coming out of it. In fact, I use the example, if you don't mind a bit of a sidetrack story. Recently, the Queensland government announced a additional coal royalty for a very there's like income tax, a higher marginal tax rate on the coal, the royalty rate at a higher price. And what they did in the budget announcement was put two additional high sort of income bracket tax rates on for coal royalties, which during this boom will get them billions more revenue. But what they didn't do is consult widely for that for a year, run a summit about it, and give their political opponents time to organize against it. What they did is they announced it in the budget and said, you owe us at the end of the month this new royalty, and just didn't give anyone enough time to organize against it. So when I see things like the summit, you know, it looks a lot to me like coordinating insiders and making sure everybody's kept happy, so when we do something, we have our story straight.
And I would argue also something else. You know, 195,000 skilled migrants was announced as part of it today, right? Well, they've actually got now cover from pretty much all of those big power blocks, because they're all in the room.
Yeah, so the migration issue, I think, has been really interesting lately, because we had the closed borders for a couple of years and the labour market's the best it's ever been. I think a lot of people have realised that, hang on a minute, maybe in the entry-level workers, migration was, keeping wage growth down for the last decade. So I think it's pretty obvious to a lot of people that the previous rate was, I think, beyond the optimal. I don't want zero, obviously. I like the exchange of culture and ideas and skills, but we're about double what I think is optimal. And obviously that benefits all the local monopolies. The property developers have more customers. The local press has more customers. Obviously foreigners don't want to read Aussie news or ads for Aussie products. And so there's a very common interest there to just juice that number quite high. And that's what we've got. We'll see how it plays out. I think Labor might find that, Kevin Rudd with his big Australia resulted in a one-term government. And if they're doing the same thing again, let's see what the people think about it. I'm just not sure it's good politics for the Labor Party in the long run.
No, well, I have my doubts too. And also, of course, everybody else, all many other Western countries are going through the same process of trying to entice skilled migrants. New Zealand did it a couple of months ago and other countries too. So it's not like it's an uncontested area as well.
Yeah. Look, the funny part about the skills system, we call it skilled migrants, but remember the median salary is much lower than the average or the median local salary of the skilled migrant program. So, one of the contested parts of this is, well, if we want skills, why don't we have a minimum salary that's at least above the median, right? Put it in the top 30%. Surely that's where the skills are. And, a lot of people come out and say, well, that would crush the program. And then the question is, well, what is the program doing if it's not getting highly skilled people who can be in the top 30% of the income brackets? It's an interesting debate. To be honest, it's been going for so long in Australia, this high immigration and the debate. I think the COVID shock might actually change the politics of it, though.
Well, we should watch with interest. And certainly, of course, one of the questions which comes to mind is 195,000 people need somewhere to live. And that takes us directly into the housing discussion. Now, back in 2020, you actually published a very important piece of thinking which basically argued why house prices were going to go up. I guess let's explore that a little bit and then basically update it. What do you think is going to happen now?
It's really funny, Martin, because I was on it was the Nucleus Wealth Macro Business podcast, and I had 9 reasons in May 2020 why house prices were much more likely to rise 20% than fall 20%. And it's funny because on social media, people said, "Where did this guy get his degrees? The back of a cornflakes packet? What kind of nonsense is he spouting?" Right? This was the time when banks were stress testing for 30% price declines in the housing market, stress testing their mortgage books and so on. But to me, the big driving factor there was just the interest rates. They'd been coming down already, and then they collapsed. And you can rent, the way I explain it is say, well, you can either rent money or rent a house. They're your options. And if the price of renting money just halved, all those people are going to switch from renting houses to renting money. Just, it's just much cheaper, right? And that's what happened. We actually had record first home buying in the 2020-2021 financial year. I think it was around 171,000 first home buyer loans when the 5-year average before that was 85,000 per year. So double basically in that 1 year period. So that seemed obvious, and that was actually a global pattern. The US, Canada, the UK, New Zealand, a lot of first home buyers jumped in because you could rent $1 million for 20,000 a year, which is cheaper than what you were paying to rent that $1 million home. And that's what happened. Now, the tide has turned, and the reverse is also true. So, renting money at 2% versus 4 or 5% is a big, big deal. People often get the scales wrong. They say, well, mortgage rates went up in the 2000s during the boom from 7 to 9%. That's a 2% rise, but that's in relative. You've got to think about it in relative terms, not in absolute terms. So that's from 7 to 9 is only 25%, whereas 2 to 4 is 100% increase in the interest you're paying on your mortgage. So what we're seeing globally right now, because of the higher interest rates, we're seeing it in the US, the Canada and New Zealand, who are all a little bit in front of us, it's just a sudden stop in new mortgages and prices just turning straight down. So I think Australia, all we've got to do is look to New Zealand and subtract 3 months, and that's I think a good gauge of what's going to happen in the mortgage market. And it's a bit sort of a bit of a shame that we're so dependent now on the Reserve Bank's decisions about monetary policy. But I think it's also good that people are realizing, was monetary policy really the right macroeconomic stabilization tool? When you have a pandemic, is the right thing to do to make mortgages cheaper and house prices more expensive? Or perhaps should we be looking at a broader range of stabilization policies in the macroeconomy? Maybe fiscal policy for these short-term shocks was more appropriate than monetary policy, because we're stuck in this ratchet now where trying to undo what we did has very bad feedback effects through the economy. The cash flow of those 171,000 new first home buyers, if they're borrowing $500,000 on average, that's another $10,000 or $15,000 of after-tax dollars they're going to pay per year just on the interest. It's like rents going up 40% in a year for that group, right? So what do I think is going to happen next? We've had quite a substantial adjustment in prices downwards in Sydney, at least, and Melbourne a little, and Brisbane's catching up. So it's already 8% by the time, we get to the end of the month. We're probably over 10% in Sydney. Remember, Sydney prices already fell 15% in 2017 to 2019. Then they went up and now they're falling again. So if you look on a much longer term, they haven't been that out of control. The other interesting part that's going on is yields, therefore, are rising. So not only because of rising rents, but the slightly declining prices, the actual yield you get as an investor is better than it was a few years ago when interest rates were similar to what they are now. So I think there's a few options of what's going to happen. One, prices will keep declining for a while. The market will get very thin. Fewer people will participate. Sellers will get more patient. And there'll be a point where everybody panics, second half of next year, hypothetically. I'm not saying that's the most likely, but that's one way things could go. Another way things could go is that the Reserve Bank realizes that people are getting really sensitive to this extra half or 1% interest rate, and we're going to slow down or stop. And we've seen the Federal Reserve already announce we're going to be more data-driven with the hiking cycle. And if that's the case, what we might see is a little bit of investor catch-up buying come through and support that. So we've got very patient sellers, and then if investors come through, we might see a little bit of a run on new apartments and things like that, investor buying, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the yields are looking okay. And secondly, a lot of people who are in the market for investor apartments have very large incomes that they're going to realize in October. They've paid a lot of tax on this year, and they might want to get those depreciation schedules and negatively gear and tuck some money away into property. So that's what I think another option might be. Remember, in 2003, Sydney prices dropped substantially, but other prices sort of held out. And then we had a little bit more of a rise later on. I think that's quite possible. But if the Reserve Bank goes a full extra percent or more, I think potentially that feedback and panic, and then they'll drop interest rates in 12 months as that feeds through the economy. So they're sort of my most likely scenarios, I think. And also depends what happens globally, because the same dynamics are at play in the US and the UK and New Zealand. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Now, the RBA says they've got no influence on house prices, and APRA says house prices have nothing to do with them. You just made the point that actually the crude key dynamic was effectively interest rates, directly or indirectly. So why is it the RBA says they've got no influence on house prices then?
Yeah, that's a very interesting puzzle, because after the 2008 financial crisis, 2009, the Bank of England came out and said, oh, by the way, you know, monetary policy has a really big effect on house prices, and therefore has very important implications for overall equality or inequality in the economy, which I thought was very interesting, but was for some reason quite ignored. The Reserve Bank seems to want to have it both ways a little bit. They'll publish, it's all right on their website. It says, how does monetary policy work? Oh, well, we decrease the interest rate. People can borrow more to buy houses. And so they go up in value. And when they go up in value, they borrow against them and they buy boats and they do renovations. And that's how we get economic activity. It's right there on their website. Yep. But I think you don't want to publicize that, because it opens the door to all these questions of inequality, insiders and outsiders. Everyone who owns property benefits from the interest rate ratchet as monetary policy comes down. Everyone who's outside can get a temporary benefit. I think that's important to note. So when during COVID, all those first home buyers got that temporary benefit and flooded in, but you know, in the long run, you know, the average buyer is not going to benefit. They're always going to have a bigger deposit, seem like a bigger hurdle, a larger mortgage that is also going to tie them to future interest rate decisions, right? So the more young people that have bigger mortgages, the more sensitive we all become to future interest rate decisions. And I think it's just too big conceptually of a problem to start talking about. So it's best not to talk about it till it's too late. And I think that's a little bit what's going on when APRA says it's not really a big deal. And the RBA says, well, it's not a concern unless it, you know, financial stability is not our thing, even if we create instability. I think it's more just, this is how we do it. This is too big a question. It needs some strong political capital to go out and talk about this or change something. So we don't have anyone with political capital to burn on talking about monetary policy. So I think we're just going to muddle through as we've been doing.
And of course, in New Zealand, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand now has a specific obligation to think about the impact on home prices on its policy.
Does that mean that they should stabilise them at the current ridiculously high level and stop putting interest rates up?
No, they're saying they need to come down another 20% at least, is what the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is saying. And in fact, the other day, he was over in Jackson Hole, gave an interview and said 4 to 4.25 is probably where we're going to end up. So.
I just think it's going to be a very interesting economy with the cash rate is over 4% in New Zealand and people are paying 6.5-7% mortgage interest rates. The buyers in the last 2 years are just, you know, usually your new buyers are quite a politically important cohort, young families, people in their 30s. I think, yeah, that'll be quite an interesting time.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one last topic I wanted to touch on, and coming back to rigs and those things, housing supply, land supply. Mm-hmm. That's an archetypal example of how political influence and political capital is playing out, not necessarily to the benefit of ordinary Australians, it seems to me.
Yeah, in what way do you mean there, Martin?
Yeah, so my suggestion is that a local council might be actually more convinced to allow a high-rise development because of the income flows that they get. And of course, some of those big developers like to put high-rise up because they actually make more money off that sort of transaction. You know, you can exploit the land more. And of course, if the value of the land is higher, you know, that changes the economics of the whole development cycle as well.
Yeah, the way I see that playing out is it's not so much that the councils want the money. I find... you know, we have this in mind that councils do things to make money, but then they go and not charge for things and give things away. For example, in the ACT, there's a 75% tax on the increase in value when you want to use your land for the upzoned purpose. So the very fact that no one wants to do that means that the councils don't want the money. They want the private landowner to have the value when they change their planning scheme. I see upzoning as a really big part of the political game because it gives away really valuable property rights. I think it's best to think of it conceptually as air rights. So it's just as if, for example, you owned a property next to a park, and if you owned the park, you could build a building twice as large. And the council says, oh, okay, here, have the park for free. Everyone would be up in arms. But we kind of own the airspace above that, right, communally, when it's zoned for a certain height. So if I ask for that airspace from the community, the council says, yeah, it's yours for free. You can build a building twice as big now. Conceptually, it's just the same had we built the building twice as wide or twice as tall. But in one case, we give the air rights for free, and in one case, we give the air rights that touch the ground. We charge the market price. So that's where the big game is in upzoning. And it's not that councils benefit so much. In fact, one of the big problems with councils at the moment in New South Wales and Victoria, particularly where they have caps on their rates, is that they can't raise the money to pay for the infrastructure to support some of these things. The incentives are a little bit different. But in terms of giving away value to landowners, that's one of the examples in the book, is the value of upzoning. And it's just a great big honeypot out there for a landowner to get those additional air rights. And what's happened lately is that there's been a weird alignment of property developers who love upzoning because it gives them value, and this YIMBY movement that's going on in the US, which is all about, you know, upzone to make housing cheaper, right? And they're like, well, if you let developers build more on each site, they will build faster and flood the market and prices will come down. And that misconstrues two concepts. One is density, the amount of dwellings on a site, and the rate of new housing. Just because you can build a bigger building doesn't mean you're going to go, whoopsie, I'm going to flood the market now and bring down the price by selling twice as quickly, right? You're going to sell at the same optimal number of units per month that market can absorb. And so, yeah, you end up with now this weird political alignment of these, YIMBY groups who think upzoning makes housing cheaper, and the landowners who know that upzoning just gives them a free property right, and they may or may not ever choose to capitalize that and build those buildings. So that's just a weird case of this myth-making around property. And I've actually written on my Substack recently about the case of the UCLA Lewis Center, it's called, which is a research group inside the university, which is sponsored by Randall Lewis, the Lewis family. And they're the equivalent of Harry Triguboff. They're California's Harry Triguboff. And they're in there at the university saying, please upzone all these people, housing supply, you know, we will make things cheaper. If you go to the Lewis Corporation's website, you'll read that they have 50,000 zoned and undeveloped lots for detached housing that they're land banking for future opportunities, and 16,000 sites for apartments that they're waiting for future opportunities. So these guys are the greatest land bankers out there. They just want upzoning before they actually build something because it's free money for them, and they've infiltrated the university by sponsoring this group. And so, you know, as I would say in Rigged, this is great myth-making to change the narrative so that when you get that political decision in your favor, you go and upzone the Lewis's undeveloped plots, you can then turn around and have a university say, that's good for everybody. So that's, you know, that's sort of the origin story of my interest in political corruption as well, because I used to work for property developers and see a lot of these giveaways, and that the game was really about getting the political decision, not building buildings.
And just to sort of build that out slightly, because one of the things that I think is very important is to understand the relationship between the structures within sort of the rigged environment you've spoken about and the way that the media works as well, particularly the mainstream media, because what I've noted is that quite often a lot of the messages they want to get out, they also spend a lot of time and effort making sure that the mainstream media are parroting what they want.
I don't know if your experience in the last few years has been like mine, Martin, in terms of dealing with the press, but I was very naive when I first was talking to the press about Game of Mates and my research on housing, because I spoke to journalists as if they wanted to learn the concepts, like as if they're a student in a class and were trying to convey these concepts. but more they just need a quote because they've got to fill up the space and get ads on the website. And so they don't really want to understand your theory and test it against others, because they've got many things like that. You know, it's not just your article they're writing. It's not, there's many, many things going on, right? And there's a lot of incentives in these organizations. And so you can see how they end up going, well, I better get the opinion of this person and this person and this person, package it up. That's, you know, it seems reasonable and fair, but there's never a test of, hey, you said this last year and it didn't happen, and now you're saying this year and it's not happening. Should I keep talking to you? And I've asked journalists before, you know, what makes a story news? Like, a lot of what gets in the press is there because someone wants it there. And a lot of them don't really know either. They're just like, well, you know, if a celebrity does this, we talk about it 10 times, 5 front pages. And if this happens, well, if we've covered it once, that's enough. A recent example was, I live now in the greenest electorate in the country. I've got a green councillor, green state member, and a green federal member in Brisbane, in West End. And our new federal member is Max Chandler Mather, and he did his speech in federal parliament without a tie. Now, the tie got multiple stories in the press. What's wrong with this guy not wearing a tie in parliament? Meanwhile, many other politicians have not worn a tie in parliament. And just one article about the content of the speech, about, you know, all the things they want to shake up, their mass public housing program they want to implement. And I just thought, who decided that multiple stories about his tie or lack of it were more important than the other way around, where we should have had multiple stories about the content of the speech and probably none about his tie? And this is just indicative of the way the press needs to just latch on to, you know, I don't, clickbait in a way, stories. And my next book, I'll give you a heads up, is going to be about the housing market. It'll come out next year. I'm currently working on it. And a lot of that's going to be, why does the press say these stories about the housing market and not these? You know, are you getting a wrong concept of how the housing market works because of the filter of the press? That's going to be one of the parts of it for sure.
Well, I can't wait but for that to come out and read it and get you come back and talk about it again. If people want to find more about your research, where's the best place for them to go?
So I'm pretty regular on Twitter at Dr. Cameron Murray, and Substack is now where I put my writing, usually once a week on a Sunday night. I write some commentary, some drafts of what I'm working on, some graphs I've made, some new data. So that's fresheconomicthinking.substack.com, and you can subscribe there. And there's a podcast as well, so you can just keep up to date with these ideas and thinking on housing. Superannuation is another topic I write a lot about, and quite a few areas of economics, migration, fertility was a recent post, for example. So, hopefully your listeners find some value there.
And with regard to Rigged, of course, it's available in all good bookshops, as they say, and all the online ones as well, right?
It is available anywhere you can buy a book. You should be able to get it.
I recommend it.
Please tell your friends.
Exactly right. Well, look, thanks very much for spending some time with us. Really enjoyed it. And you made some really, really important points. And I'm sure the viewers will be very interested in following up. And I'd like maybe to have you come back and talk some more, because there's a lot more we could explore, I think.
For sure. I'd love to do it, Martin. Great to chat.
Thanks very much. Have a good afternoon. See you. Bye-bye.